Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Picture this. Tell me this hasn't happened to you. You're at your home and you're ready to sit down to dinner and all of a sudden you're saying, oh my, you say, oh, I need this document. It's back on my computer at the office. What are you going to do? You're going to have to go back. Nope. It's good news. With GoToMyPC, you don't need to make that trip back to the office because GoToMyPC, that is brought to you by Citrix, lets you easily access your office PC in just a few clicks. Setup takes probably just about 2 minutes. And just like that, you're free to work from anywhere. GoToMyPC is easy to set up, easy to log into, and easy to use. So be sure to try GoToMyPC. I love it. I use it often because I'm always kind of logging in and, you know, finding information that I left over there and need to grab and actually transfer. But you can do so for 30 days for free. So for this special offer, you go to www.gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for the free trial. Good day and good evening. Good morning. This is Andrew Horowitz and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. How are you? We're closing in on some very interesting times here. We have a stimulus package that is oh so not stimulating. So it seems a lot of fighting and infighting, but in the end they did pass it by just the narrowest of margins. Well, I mean, they passed it, let's be honest, but no partisanship at all. Republicans stayed back and did what they do best. I guess so did Democrats, right? But in the end, on all of this, we have a stimulus package that is a much different plan than when it was originally formulated by President Barack Obama. Whereas we're going to have a FDR-like New Deal style of plan, but that didn't seem to really come out as well as he wanted to, as he had to give way to some of the Republicans, who frankly didn't vote for his bill anyway, as he wanted to. So what was the point of that, I guess? Nonetheless, we do have something that's going to be signed into law probably in the next number of days. And I don't think it's something we need to be extraordinarily happy about right now, even though we want to hope, we want to believe, we want to say all these wonderful things and come up with this terrific kind of feeling of, you know, just wow, things are going to be okay. Every prediction, every economist, for whatever they're worth, has shown that it's going to take several months to get it into the economy. Now, here's what's interesting. Think about this for a moment. We have a dying patient, and that's our economy. And at the same time, we have a miracle drug, which is the stimulus plan. And the miracle drug is told by the doctors that it's going to take care of the ailing patient and really solve all the problems. And we're so relieved because the patient, we're told, only has, let's say, 1 month to live. Well, unfortunately, the doctors then tell you that the miracle drug is not quite ready yet, but it will be ready soon. As a matter of fact, it will be ready in 3 months. And you say, doctor, excuse me. Excuse me. My patient here, my loved one, is going to be, is going to pass in 1 month. And you're telling me 3 months? How does that exactly work? Well, unfortunately, that's kind of the situation we have right now. Our economy has been, you know, really contracting at such a rapid pace, and the stimulus bill, which only a small part of it is going to be able to be put into place in the short term. That's really just the tax cuts or the tax credits and some of the abatements that they have lined up on with relation to tax cuts. And the bigger issue of getting people back to work or stopping the bleed, if you will, is going to take a lot longer. So my biggest concern right now is how do we play this with the knowledge that it's going to be a continual slide down, even if confidence, investor confidence, is buoyed a little bit by this and is really, you know, put into a better place. How do we deal with it now? How do we invest now? I will tell you that for our clients, we have been trying our best to be a little bit less trade happy, trigger happy, if you will, but that doesn't seem to be working. I'll tell you that, you know, this is a trader's market. You get in, you get out. You get out, you get in. whether it's hedging, whether it's scalping or day trading, whether it's swing trading, you cannot marry anything right now. Even if I met some people this weekend at a party, they said, you know, what's the difference? I'm going to buy GE now. I'm going to buy Cisco now. And, you know, in the end, 5-10 years from now is when I really am looking for this opportunity. But I said, you know what? How much pain are you looking to endure? Are you willing to endure in the short term? So with that, I think that the reality here is that there is going to be some problems right now. We are seeing a whole host of issues with General Motors and the UAW, who is not backing down, and they have a deadline to get their plan of emergency money, their action plan to the government in a couple of days. And it looks to me like right now that there is no way that General Motors is going to do that. And what's that going to mean to the markets, the unemployment rate, moving forward next week? I mean, the news right now is a flurry of additional mini Madoffs. We have the Stanford financial situation. It's funny, I have a story about that. I'm not going to go into the details, but bottom line is they would have CDs of 8, 9, 10% in the international CDs for a long time. And I had a couple of clients that came to me and said, Andrew, what do you think of this? And I said, how are they doing that? I mean, that's the big question. If you ever ask yourself, how do they do that? I mean, how do they not just not making money, not losing money, or maybe just making a little bit of money, but making so much money on something that's quote-unquote guaranteed? You gotta wonder if it's too good to be true. As simplistic as that seems, it probably is. But I don't want to take up too much time. I got a couple of things I want to share with you today. I have a great guest that's coming on who is, I think he's going to, this is a guy who I've listened to, and he is, you've probably heard of him too. It's Mark Faber. He's the editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. And Dr. Faber is, he's one of the fine gents who called a lot of the biggest concerns and the ongoing concerns of these markets. And I had a lot of people that asked me to get him on, and we're going to give a call to Thailand in a short moment to talk with him. I also want to bring to you some of the things. I was on CNBC. I was on thestreet.com. We got a gig lined up supposedly with a Jon Stewart show, and all sorts of interesting things have happened lately. And the biggest issue is that I won the MSN Strategy Lab Round 18 Champion, up 14.5% since August 1st. And when the markets were down about 35% in that time period, and in accepting this, what we did was I went up to New York and did some video shoots with MSN, and we have a whole little present for everyone. Kind of for my acceptance speech, I am giving away a free copy of my book. And at the end of this podcast today, after we talk to Dr. Faber, I will tell you exactly how you can get that. You'll be the first to know, as a matter of fact, how you can get your hands on the free copy of my book, The Disciplined Investor. So don't worry about buying it yet. If you can download that, I'll show you how to do that at the end of this. And I want to bring you also some of the clips from some of the discussions I had at thestreet.com and CNBC. So other than that, I think there's so many things that we could talk about in the news. Next week, I'm going to kind of try to consolidate many things that we're seeing and how the effect of the stimulus bill and what the effect on the markets and the sentiment on investors, what that really does to the markets moving forward, and try to bring you some ideas that make a lot of sense in terms of investing. And, you know, the good news is that, you know, we've insulated our clients from a lot of the pain right now, because we are realizing that a lot of the discussion is much more kind of a feather ruffling, and I guess the best way to describe it, it's a posturing. The hope is that a lot of this discussion by our congressional leaders and administration, this posturing is, you know, something that is right now, well, rather empty. Matter of fact, one of the things that's been bothering me is President Barack Obama keeps on saying this phrase. He says, we're going to create or save 3.5 million jobs. I heard that so many times. Saying, what does that mean? What does it mean to save or create 3.5 million jobs? And I realized something. You know what I realized? That is such an open phrase that can be interpreted in so many different ways that under no circumstances can be wrong. Because in the future, if we keep on losing jobs over time and the stimulus bill comes into place, and it's a failure, let's just say that. Let's just kind of put that on the table for a second. Well, maybe if he's called into question and say, you know what, you didn't save. Well, he said, yes, there could have been a lot more jobs lost. So politicking and, you know, giving us a little bit of a rhetoric, great article, by the way, in the Wall Street Journal on the whole idea of this rhetoric by our leaders, I think it hasn't helped yet. We need a lot more action, and that's hopefully what the stimulus bill is all about. And finally, before we get to Dr. Faber, I'll mention that any of the information that you want from this discussion, the links to the actual videos on CNBC, thestreet.com, are on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. be sure to take a listen to that or look at that at all times. We have a lot of little things that go on there that probably be of big interest to you. And finally, one more thing. If you've always wanted to check out what are we doing at the Disciplined Investor for our clients, I mean, how do we actually invest? What are we talking about? We have a client blog that's private. And basically, we talk about a lot of things there, and we have this real nice open communication and transparency, which seems to be one of the one things that's sorely missing in this industry. If you want to check it out, just we'll put a link on this show notes as well, but all you have to do is write to us at trial@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Tell us you want to take a 10-day free test drive, and we'll get you signed up to see what's going on, give you a kind of a bird's-eye view of what we do and how we talk with our clients about whatever subjects we talk about, okay? So we get back in just a moment. We're going to be on the phone all the way, the magic of Skype, to Thailand with Dr. Mark Favor. Thanks for joining me. Stick around. There's more on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich, and on the money tonight, the market's drastic dips have shaken up our portfolios. But have you shaken up your strategy? We'll show you how to adapt now so you can protect and grow what you've got. And think the tax man's taking too much of your money? You might be overpaying Uncle Sam, so we're opening the phone lines to answer your tax questions. And he was the breadwinner. Now he's laid off. How it's affecting his family and his finances. But first up, we're revealing the secret weapon in the back pocket of the most successful investors, the ability to adapt. When it's cold, you put on a coat. When there's a traffic jam, you take a different route. And when the economy heads south and stays there, you've got to adapt. To help guide you, we've brought in two independent certified financial planners tonight. Doug Flynn, co-founder of Flynn Zito Capital Management, and Andrew Horowitz, president of Horowitz & Company and author of The Disciplined Investor. They're ready to roll up their sleeves and get to work on your money. All right, so guys, what does this mean in terms of adapting to today's market? This is something like we have not seen in generations. We've got to adapt. What are we going to do, Andrew?
I mean, right now, we're telling our clients, adapt or die. I mean, essentially, we've never seen anything like this, like you said. And basically, you can't just do what you've always done. So right now, the whole idea of changing your whole investment philosophy, your outlook, and really changing your thought process about what will work and really what can work in the future has to be really dealt with right now.
Hi, I'm Frank Kersey. I'm here with Andrew Horowitz, Disciplined Investor Everything, podcast, book, right? Yeah. And your blog as well. Let's talk a little bit about the markets first. We'll start off there. Retesting the lows.
Yeah.
Are you worried?
I'm worried. I mean, there's nothing that I see that's going to really stop it right now. There's no miracle that's coming out. The miracle of the stimulus package, the miracle of the TARP trap, BARF, whatever you want to call it right now, whatever the real the usage of that.
Yeah.
There's nothing I see that's going to stop this, short of, a lot of hope and miracles.
What about long-term? Do you think the stimulus, I mean, we have low interest rates, a stimulus plan coming through, anything you see, say, 18 months from now, silver lining?
At all? 18, yeah, I can talk about 18 months from now. I can't talk about 6 months from now, because 6 months from now is very difficult going. 18 months from now, when we see a lot of things hitting, when we see potentially this, shovel-ready kind of work going, we see all of a sudden the worldwide growth happening. I mean, I love the agricultural stock still. I love anything that you have to eat. At the end of the day, you don't have to wear clothes. Mm-hmm. You don't have to drive a car. You have to eat.
I like to eat.
Yeah. we're together, my friend.
All right, let's get to some themes and top themes that are talked about on the Real Money website, which you're going to be writing for us. Yeah. I get to introduce you. How cool is
That's
that?
That's great. I'm excited.
All right. And I'm excited to read your work. So a lot of people are going to read it as well because you're great. Now, let's talk about China. A lot of people on China right now. We saw a terrible export number. What's your thesis on it? Considering that, we're off our lows with China, but right now, because we're off our lows, it seems like to be a theme. A lot of people are jumping on board. Are you jumping on board here?
I like China. I mean, we like China the last few weeks. I started adding small amounts to China. Exports are a problem for China, no question. But you know what? Let's strip out all the exports from China entirely. They're a world unto their own with billions of people that are going to be, needing basics. And they have a stimulus package that was very quick. We didn't go through the pain that we're going through with our, system. Mm-hmm. They didn't go through that over there. And I think that China is, of course, going to be affected, no question about this. But I think that China can actually be a world to themselves, even if they cut out the rest of the world.
Gold. Everybody is on the bandwagon right now. I want to say I was fortunate and lucky to actually have a pretty good pick in my Stocks Under 10 newsletter, which is doing well. However, when I see everybody jumping on board, I'm more inclined, which I did send a note to subscribers, that take your profits now. I do like gold long term. What's your opinion? You think you could buy gold here? Or gold stocks in
general? You can buy gold stocks. I mean, GLD, you can look at Barrick and a few of the other ones that are interesting in terms of the stocks themselves. We like silver. We're trying to come to the alternatives. Anytime everybody's talking about something, I start going the other direction. Sometimes what happens is it lasts a lot longer, and then what happens, the fall is a lot greater. Mm-hmm. So consider shorting it. I think I told you this before, that you know the cataclysmic end of the world, which is the gold theory, we want to be in the bunker mentality. I'm much more inclined for tuna fish and cigarettes. They're going to be trading much better. You know, you can't really scrape off that piece of gold and say, hey, buddy, trade me your sandwich. But you got a can of tuna fish.
Yeah, good. Makes sense. Okay, now let's get into oil. A lot of news on the contango, and oil is actually coming down. From the oil guys that I talked to on my Real Story podcast, I'm sure you talked to as well in your podcast, Cushing is overflowing. We have boats out in the middle of the ocean overflowed, and a huge amount of supply, but demand is coming down. We're seeing oil cuts. Now, what's your short-term, long-term approach, and we're seeing oil coming down here?
I think short-term, you need to be very careful because the volatility is immense in oil. But I think that the boys that control oil, and we all know who that grouping is, you know, they do have a lot of ships through the contango. They say, well, you know, we can buy it at 30 and change now. We can sell it for 50 in the future. They're going to make sure that they push that up longer term. And I don't think that we're going to see oil here forever. It is, like the gold story, a commodity. It is a tangible asset. I've never been a big lover of oil. We're short right now. Exxon, as a matter of fact. And we are a very small position, but long UCO. Mm-hmm. We started to add to the UCO. When it pops up, we take our profits. Now we're a little bit looking to add a little bit to it. Mm-hmm. But we can play that both sides of the equation. I think there's a really interesting pair trade right there.
Andrew, thank you for joining us today. Also, if you get a chance, pick up his book, The Disciplined Investor. Yep. And I appreciate that I'm going to be reading a lot of your work.
Great.
So you have to put up now.
Ah, I hear you.
Yeah.
Right,
we're back. Next week, and we have a special treat today. We are joined by Mark Faber, editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. His website is www.gloomboomdoom.com. Thanks for joining us today, Mr. Faber.
It's my pleasure.
So a lot's going on. I mean, obviously, we know that we're in pretty bad straits. We've talked about it many times on the show. I get all sorts of commentary. People say to me, Andrew, why am I so negative? So there's a lot to be negative about, isn't there?
Well, I think economically, we have a horrible situation globally because the wealth destruction is universal. Equities went down. Commodities collapsed. Real estate worldwide went down, both residential and commercial, and also businesses have less value than they were worth a year ago and so forth. So we have an unprecedented wealth destruction, because if we look back at, say, the recession 73-74, home prices still went up. In 81, 82, in that recession, home prices didn't go down in the U.S. And in 1991, they went down very briefly, but just for a month, and then they rebounded. So I think the wealth destruction is colossal. And obviously, because it was phony wealth, illusionary wealth, or artificial wealth driven by credit, because credit after 1980 expanded much faster than the economy. Obviously, that poses a problem for the global economy. In a credit-driven economy, the moment credit growth slows down, you have a problem.
So one of the things that we're hearing from President Obama here in the U.S., of course, and we're talking to you from Chiang Mai, Thailand. I think we mentioned when off-air, one of my favorite places. But one of the things they're talking about, and he said in a speech, was that, you know, it's not his fault. He wasn't. He didn't create this $1 trillion debt. And now what they're doing is utilizing, it seems, another $1 trillion to try to fix the problem. And a lot of that has to do with the fact, as he says, to increase the credit availability so that we can get this economy moving again. Now, I don't know, but it seems when you just listen to it, like, oh, okay. But then stop for a second. You know what? Why in the world would I want to increase the credit again?
Well, I think you're touching on a very important point. The crisis didn't occur because home prices went down. Let's say if in the U.S. everybody held his real estate with 80% home equity and only 20% of the value of their homes in mortgages, even a 50% decline in home values wouldn't have an impact on the financial condition of a household. But the problem is, if a house is mortgaged to 100% or 120% of the value of the house, and then it drops 20 or 30%, then you have a problem. And so I fully agree, it's not Mr. Obama that created the problem. The problem was created by clowns like Mr. Bernanke, who is now the Fed chairman, who has a policy to target monetary policy according to the core inflation and not pay any attention to asset inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem occurred through easy monetary policies where the Fed fund rate was far below the rate of inflation, not core inflation, but the true cost of living increases of the typical household in the United States between 2001 and 2007. And now they try to cure the problem with actually the medicine, the bad medicine that brought about the problems, namely too much debt.
Right. I mean, it's just a replay of the same thing again. So what does the rest of the world think about us? Because I got to tell you something. I'm embarrassed. As an American, honestly, I'm not embarrassed to be an American. I'm embarrassed. Am I off base here?
Well, I mean, you don't need to be embarrassed. But if I look at Mr. Geithner.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
I think the Chinese, when they see him, they must just laugh outright. He's such an actor. He could be coming out straight of Hollywood, except he doesn't have to look for it. But basically, under him, at the Federal Reserve, he was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Under him, precisely the whole mess happened. And now he goes and tells the world how to solve the problem.
Well, we saw when he recently came out with his, I'll call it the plan with no plan, on how to fix the final fix, right? You know, the markets did not cooperate very nicely with him. And it's interesting because at first when President Obama, I don't mean to be political bashing entirely here, but I was very disappointed with the picks. I think everybody was very disappointed with Geithner as the pick. Would you agree with that?
Yes, for sure, yes. I think actually Geithner, having not paid his taxes that he should have paid, and being now in charge of collecting taxes in the United States,
yeah, something obscene.
Is a total joke.
Yeah, something obscene about that. I think it's the greatest.
But I mean, I think both Mr. Geithner and Mr. Bernanke do not have much credibility.
I would tend to agree with you.
Because when you hear them speak, you have the impression that they have no clue of what to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the best
if you have no clue what to do is to do nothing.
Right. Well, they're doing something, but that's the problem. Let me ask you, in terms of China, so the big hope, as far as I could see, of funding much of the restructuring and this whole ridiculous plan of that is necessary but unfortunate a problem. We're balancing unfortunately a situation where it's required that the government step in at this point, but the problem is the government stepping in is going to be a problem long term for us.
It's not required.
No?
Because the problem is largely government intervention starting in 1990 with the bailout of SNL, then the bailout of Mexico in 1994, then the bailout in 98 of LTCM, and I think that was a huge mistake because it gave a green light to leverage up. And after 2000, when the Nasdaq fell apart, to again try to postpone and avoid a recession. I mean, in economics, it's very simple. You have excursions into prosperity and you have excursions into recessions. And if you continuously try to postpone the recession by printing money, eventually you end up with too much debt and the depression as we have now.
And this is, we're talking about, from peak to trough, of course. That's the economic cycle.
Yes.
And they're trying to keep peak all the time because for whatever reason, it's kind of like with my children, I don't want my children to have any pain. And what they're trying to do is spare us all this pain. But inevitably, what's going to happen is the postponement of all this, we're starting to taste the poison of the postponement, right?
Actually, they don't want your children to sleep at night.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunately. Yeah,
they want to keep inflating basically the system that it continues to move forward and not let the system have resting periods. And that is very essential in economics.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Are they stupid? I mean, seriously, what is it that is so obvious to all of us that is so incredibly either not clear to them or that they're trying desperately for some reason to do something totally different? What is it?
Well, I'll tell you what it is. Most of your listeners and yourself are businessmen. They have a business.
Mm-hmm.
Some years are good, and some years sales go down, and earnings go down, and they have to make provisions for bad times during good times. But the officials at the Fed and at the Treasury, they've never run a business themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They are government officials and academics. They learned at universities some abstruse economic models that don't work, as we have seen. And they implement policies that don't work, as we have seen. And these are the people that are leading the country.
But then again, we had Paulson. Paulson was the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Yes, absolutely. But you understand, he, while at Goldman Sachs, he pressured the government to ease capital requirements for brokerage firms.
It's
he only became Secretary of the Treasury later on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a businessman, but he was not the Secretary of the Treasury. And so he didn't know how to react to the crisis in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also, like most people, a child of the bull market.
Right.
1982 to 2007. And he's never seen nor read extensively about serious downturns.
What I think, I want to
say. And what Mr. Bernanke has read about the Depression, unfortunately, he read the wrong book.
Yeah, I hear you. I think, how about this? And I want to switch over to the discussion of China, which I'm pretty hot on, and some things that you think are beneficial. When do you remember when Paulson got on one knee and begged Pelosi to make sure that do you remember that? I think
quite frankly.
Do you think there's
I've
a lot of guilt?
I've been on knees in front of women, but I wouldn't go on my knees in front of Miss Pelosi.
Yeah, well, but listen, do you agree? This is what I think. I think that was an incredible moment of guilt, unconstrained guilt by Paulson, because he was one of the main players that made this whole thing crumble. And now he was begging to please don't let this thing fall apart when he's on his watch after, of course, getting $500 million on the exit package, right?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to point fingers at who is guilty.
Mm-hmm.
All of us are guilty to some extent.
Yes.
Because Americans voted for their government and voted for the officials that are in government. They had a choice.
Yeah, well, we have a choice, but we have a terrible system.
Also, most people during the bubble years enjoyed the bubble. Rising home prices allowed them to refinance their homes, take equity out, and buy a Mercedes or consumer goods from China and so forth. And they thought it would go on forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
But you understand, if you are a barman and you hand out drinks free of charge, it's clear that the people in the bar will drink as much as they can.
Yep.
And get totally drunk. And the difference between a barman and the Fed is the barman is quite smart because he will not kill people. But the Federal Reserve has actually killed the economy.
Yeah. So where are we going? Where does this end? I mean, what is the logical progression over the next 1 year, 2 year, 3 years? What happens?
Well, usually, the longer a boom lasted and the longer an inflationary period lasted, say, we had a long inflationary period in commodities in the 60s and then culminating in 1980 with gold at $850. Afterwards, we had a 20-year bear market in gold. And I think that we had an inflationary boom, not so much in consumer prices, although consumer prices went up more, than what the Bureau of Labor Statistics is publishing. I mean, the typical household in America has probably an inflation rate or has had an inflation rate of around 5% per annum over the last 10 years. Now it's probably a bit lower. But healthcare costs, insurance costs, and contributions to the government, in other words, whatever license you need, always goes up.
Right.
And education is always going up. So it's true that, say, a mobile phone goes down in price, but other things go up. And therefore, we had some inflation, but what we especially had for the last 25 years is asset inflation. And I think this asset inflation has now come to an end. And you're not going to see the S&P at 1576 as we had in October 2007 for a long time.
What is going to do? I know you've talked about gold. I think that's one of your areas. What is that we have to be looking for? Hard assets right now? Is that really? I mean, are we talking bunker mentality, tuna fish kind of hard assets? You know, silver, gold. Is that what we're dealing with?
Well, I don't know. I'm not so keen on tuna fish. Other than that, if you want to survive, it's probably a good way to store food. But my view is simply this. It's very difficult to predict markets in a perfect market. A perfect market is a market where you have thousands and thousands of market participants, and they all buy and sell every day, and there's no intervention by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get a manipulated market by the government, it's very difficult to make any predictions, because, let's say, I could argue, if the Fed really wants to print money, they can send $1 million to each household in the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. That was my idea, too.
And
I think it's good.
And then the stock market and consumption will go up temporarily, but I suppose that the dollar would tumble.
Yeah.
You know, really fall out of bed.
That makes the assumption that the rest of the countries don't do the same thing.
I beg your pardon?
That makes the assumption that the rest of the countries around the world don't do exactly the same thing.
Yes, exactly. If all the countries do it at the same time,
right,
then the dollar may stay against other currencies at the same level, and the whole world will inflate in the sense that the purchasing power of money will diminish. And in that environment, obviously gold and assets that cannot be increased in terms of supply at the same rate as money would go up substantially, including oil.
Mm-hmm. So even though the dollar has the effect of an increasing dollar has the effect of reducing the price of oil, because it is something with limited quantity, supply demand, simple supply and demand, whereas currencies, the supply demand can be manipulated or augmented by...
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's say, you know, it's like gold. The supply is about 2,500 tons a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that won't go up, because actually the mining supply is going down.
Right. So...
And you have a fixed quantity of gold coming into the world today, and you have an unlimited amount of paper money coming into the world today.
Right.
And so I could argue the price of gold hasn't gone up. It's the price of the dollar that has gone down vis-a-vis mm-hmm. gold. Or it's the price of the Dow Jones that has gone down vis-a-vis gold.
So we're back to a relative performance discussion. That's
absolutely
what we're dealing with.
Yeah. Yes.
So what about China? China's been pointing a finger on the United States, saying it's our fault. Russia's been pointing, but they always point. So let's kind of leave them out of the discussion. It appears to me that in a very interesting way that Asia, particularly China, with the population issue, and I have not always been keen on this, but recently I'm getting very excited about this. It appears to me that China has the potential of coming out of this in a much greater greater velocity. And one of the reasons is because of the sheer magnitude of their population, the money in their piggy bank, and they have a lot of control over the United States now, don't they?
Well, I'm not sure they have a lot of control over the United States because, from a military point of view, the U.S. is still vastly superior because China doesn't have yet any aircraft carriers.
Right.
And secondly, the Chinese also depend on the U.S. because they have bought so many treasury bonds and bills.
Well, is that, but which way is that? Is that that the China, there's about, what, a $500 billion worth of treasuries that China owns, right?
Yeah, probably more.
And don't you think that they have a little bit of control? Because if they start, not that they would, but if they started to say, well, we're not buying your treasuries right now, is that something that can happen?
Yes. I mean, what will happen in the world is that, you see, the U.S. has many shortcomings, and it has had a debt bubble, and this debt bubble needs to be deflated one way or the other. But basically, the U.S. is not a highly cyclical economy because they don't produce much.
Anymore?
Yes. I mean, in the 20s, it was, and in the 50s, it was way ahead of other countries in terms of industrial production.
But starting with the 80s,
That's no longer the case.
Mm-hmm.
Now what happens when an economic expansion takes place, consumption in the U.S. is stimulated by the government, which, by the way, I think is the wrong policy. The U.S. should stimulate capital investment and not consumption. But anyway, they do stimulate consumption, and then industrial production lags behind consumption, and so the trade deficit goes up. And then the exports from other countries, notably China, increase. And as the exports from Chinese manufacturers increase, they build new capacities. And so there is capacity expansion, income increases, consumption increases in China. So basically, China is a much more cyclical economy than the United States. That would also apply to South Korea and the resource producers of the world. When the U.S. goes into recession, well, tough luck. So consumption drops 5% or 10%, then Americans have to tighten their belts a little bit. But macroeconomically, it's not as disastrous as for the emerging world, because the emerging world then has less exports and then cuts immediately capital spending because of overcapacities. And so the recessions are more, or let's say, the business cycle is much more pronounced in emerging economies, much more cyclical than in the U.S.
And that's because they have a business cycle. We don't. The diversification in the business that they have is actually a hindrance on them. Whereas we basically offshored everything. So what we have,
yes, exactly.
What happened?
We're basically they are very cyclical, and at the present time, I mean, the Chinese government has learned one thing from the U.S. government. They haven't learned much. But one thing they learned is how to cheat on economic statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will publish that they're growing at 7%. But I can assure you, if I look at, say, exports from South Korea to China, exports from Taiwan to China, and these are components that go into Chinese manufacturing and they are then sold either domestically or in export products, then I would say the Chinese economy is definitely, I mean, 100% in a recession.
And do you have any model country around the world or anything that we can hang our hats on that says that's a good economy, that's a good model, that's something we want to go by?
I have a model economy, but let me first tell you the model economy of Mr. Bernanke, and that's Zimbabwe.
Uh-oh. That's not a good thing.
No.
What happened to just for my listeners who don't know about Zimbabwe, can you just give me one minute?
It's run by Robert Mugabe. He's an academic. He's highly intelligent. He speaks, incidentally, extremely well. He's very charismatic, like Mr. Obama. But as someone wrote in the Harare, that's the capital of Zimbabwe, Herald Tribune, he said, "We don't understand that America is so excited about the black president. We had one for more than 20 years, and we're impoverished."
Well, their dollar is set, the Zimbabwe dollar. I don't know what is the actual name of the Zimbabwe dollar. It's
Zimbabwe dollar.
They have
now $50 billion notes. It's a hyperinflation country.
Yeah,
inflation is above, say, $1 million per annum.
Yeah, their currency is worth essentially zero.
It's a beautiful country, And I recommend your listeners to go to Victoria Falls. It's a very unusual spot.
And I'm assuming it's cheap.
The largest waterfalls in the world.
Right.
They have great bungee jumping and great river rafting.
Well, we'll put it on my list, and I think probably it's going to be pretty cheap. Pretty inexpensive to go.
No, I'm not sure because they price it in dollars for foreigners.
Oh, there you go. So you got to go. But a short trip, because if you go on a long trip, it gets more expensive as you stay there. Right? Don't stay more than a week. It gets very difficult to live. Or
but
pack
I
your
would say, personally, I think that Singapore, which is not the perfect democracy, it's run essentially by a family, but the family ran it in a very, on a relative basis, honest way.
Mm-hmm.
And the leader of Singapore for many years, Lee Kuan Yew, he never got carried away, and he always educated the people in Singapore that bad times, that in bad times you have to tighten your belts and just wait and work harder and stay competitive. So I think it's actually, economically speaking, a very good model.
So
and
Singapore.
Singapore was the first country in the world to actually tell its citizens we are in a very bad recession.
So the do you have any, and I just want to get back to HA one second, but do you have any, you talk about cheating on the economics, on the economic statistics. Do you have any real vision of what our true unemployment rate is here in the U.S. and what some of the real growth factors of GDP are compared to what we're being told?
Well, there are all kinds of statistics that show, say, unemployment being far higher than it is shown. But I'm not so sure about that because, you know, a lot of people, they may not report when they work, so they save on taxation. I think in America, most people, if they really want to work, they will find a job. But obviously not a job that pays well.
Right.
But, so, I mean, it's still a large economy. It's a population of 300 million people. The people in America are very flexible and so forth. But for sure, business is bad in America. I mean, there's, all the statistics point to essentially an incredible slump. And not only do we have an incredible slump, but the way it happened, the economy globally fell off a cliff between September and today.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how fast it happened. It's almost like it was waiting to happen. So are we in a depression in the United States? Are we in a depression? Are we going to be in a depression? Does it matter if we're in a depression?
Well, I mean, when I travel around the world, 18 months ago, every country was in boom conditions. And now, because I talk always to people, I'm not interested in what Bernanke has to say and Mr. Geithner, because they don't know anything. But I'm interested to listen to people, say, who run hotels or are drivers or taxi drivers or waiters and so forth. I just ask them, how is business? Usually, the answer is down between 20 and 40% vis-a-vis a year ago. But surprisingly, some restaurants and bars and so forth are still quite full. I mean, it's not a total disaster. I mean, if this is depression, then I would say depression is not all that bad.
Right, yeah, well, I live in Miami, and I got to tell you something. They're still partying down here like nothing ever occurred.
Yes, but I also think there is a reason for that.
And?
I think the first reaction of people to having lost a lot of money, say rich people, have probably lost roughly 50% of their net assets. If they were leveraged more, if they had large cash positions and bonds, less. In other words, government bonds, because on corporate bonds, they also lost a lot of money. But let's say they lost roughly 40, 50% of their money. Then they go away and they say to themselves, okay, we lost so much money on investments. What is it to spend another few thousand dollars on having a good time?
Mm.
That is the first reaction.
Right.
Later on, the reality will set in, and probably they will be, or what they will do is postpone the purchase of a new car. instead of buying a new car this year, they'll buy it in 3 years' time. Yeah. So some sectors of the economy, the more cyclical sectors, will be affected more badly.
Right.
But one thing is very clear. The corporate sector is cutting costs. So let's say now the hotels, the room rates have come down. The airlines tickets have actually not come down because they cut capacities and so forth. But let's say hotel rooms have come down. And in some restaurants, depends which restaurant, the business is off quite considerably.
Right. So just let's go back to China and we'll close this up here. And so again, you think that gold potentially has a good opportunity. Do you think, as I do?
Well, I think, let's put it this way. What has happened last year, gold went up by 6% in U.S. dollar terms. And industrial commodities totally collapsed. The nickel from $53,000 a ton down to $10,000. So relative to other commodities, gold is actually quite expensive. And I think that if someone wanted to bet on an economic recovery, which I don't think will happen anytime soon, but we can have a lot of economic volatility simply because at the present time we have zero interest rates. The economy has fallen off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next 2-3 months, the economic statistics could look slightly better than the market participants expected them to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so the market may actually rebound a little bit here.
Right.
Actually, I wouldn't be surprised to see the S&P. We were at 741 on November 21st.
Right.
Then we rebounded to over 900. We were up 27% from trough to peak.
Right.
I think we can easily get a 20% rally here. And in emerging economies, we could easily get like a 30% upward move.
But what would be the catalyst for that? I mean, right now everything is pointing to just, you know, every economic indicator is awful. I mean, some of the earnings are coming in better, but they're better on reduced expectations.
During the hyperinflation years in Germany, there was an article in the paper in Germany that said the stock market soared probably because of the horrible economic news, because they knew the worse the economy looks, the more they will print money. And I tell you, Mr. Bernanke is a dangerous man. He's a money printer.
Hmm.
He shouldn't be in his job.
Right.
He's a destroyer of the value of paper money.
But he's not the king and the ruler. Isn't there people around him that are giving him checks and balances? He's not the one.
You listen at these congressional hearings. All these clowns are hopeless, except for Ron Paul. He understands a little bit something about economics. But the other ones, they don't understand anything. And Mr. Obama, I'm sorry to say, he has no clue either.
Oh, it's a very scary situation here, and I got to tell you something, not the place for the average investor to be messing around. I think we both agree with that.
Well, I think that we are in a trading market. You know, you can make a lot of money if you buy assets when they're oversold and then they rally 20%. Then you have to sell them again. I don't think it's a very good environment for long-term investment, but if someone said to himself, well, stocks haven't earned any money for 10 years. Statistically, when this happens, the future return is usually higher.
Right, reversion to the mean.
I'm going to buy shares for the next 10, 20 years.
Then
I would say Asian shares are much cheaper than U.S. shares.
Agreed.
With a larger or more significant economic growth prospect. Because in America, the S&P yields about the same or now again slightly less than, say, long-term treasury bonds. But here in Asia, in many markets, the dividend yield is 3 times the local bond yield. Now, I think the dividends will be cut, but say even if they're cut by 70%, at least you're paid to wait.
Right. Well, the big concern is, you know, how much destruction is going to happen if we get nationalization of the banks. I mean, I got to tell you something. I am so spooked about these banks right now and the dividend cuts and the potential for, you know, them taking out some of these banks. Obviously, the government's the last thing they want to do is nationalize these banks and take these under because, I mean, we're just talking about the enormity of that situation and running them is just ridiculous. But at this point, it appears to me that many of these banks are holding back some very serious understandings from anybody. They know what's going on. They know how bad things are on their books. They're holding those back. We see them leak out every quarter. The insurance companies are a disaster. You know, we saw Aflac and Humana and Prudential. I mean, it's a disaster. And unfortunately,
yeah, AIG, the government has already put in more than $200 billion.
I mean, these numbers are ridiculous, too. Come on, you've been doing this a long time. They're ridiculous.
But I would say the best would have been to let them fail and let the banks fail, go bankrupt, and then you guarantee the depositors
right.
of the banks.
Yeah,
you have a $10,000 deposit with the bank. That is then guaranteed by the government. But the rest is the business of the financial sector. And yeah. believe me, the world is not going to be much poorer if the financial sector disappears. Yeah. Because the financial sector, the way it's grown, is totally unproductive.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And that, by the way, I mean, you look at, I get hate mail with what I'm about to say. You know, Warren Buffett made incredible sums of money, obviously the richest man, on his brilliant financial moves on majority of his investments are what? Financials, right?
Yes, but his fund hasn't made any money in 10 years.
Not only that, if you were to look not knowing that it was Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, and you would open the door and look at those investments, you would say, what's that crap?
Yes,
right
I
or wrong,
see.
Right?
I agree.
I mean, if you didn't know it was him, it would be, you know, like, oh, I mean, once you put on the label, it's him, it's a brilliant move, of course, in somehow. And at the end of the day, I'll tell you one more thing in closing. You know, back in the summer, we were very vocal about the shenanigans that were going on with the oil and the whole Enron loophole and the manipulation. And we're seeing this contango again. I'm seeing a lot of oil, even though we have all these tankers around the world now holding all this oil to sell the futures because they're a lot higher. Do you still think that oil is going to be a major play and a lot higher than it is today, or at least somewhat higher than it is today, because it is one of those core resources that has, you know, that supply and demand is involved, like you were mentioning before, with the hard assets and tuna fish? Well, maybe not tuna fish, but the hard assets?
Well, let's put it this way. At this level of oil prices, nobody will carry out any exploration.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the supply will be limited. And the demand in the Western world, in industrialized countries, will not go up much. And probably maybe even shrink because of conservation and more efficient use of energy. But I can tell you in Asia, we have 3.6 billion people, and we consume the same quantity of oil as the U.S. with 300 million people. For sure, in Asia, the demand will go up.
Yep, I hear you.
Because on a per capita basis, it's very limited. And then there's a political element in oil that is very difficult to gauge because you don't know what will happen in different countries, especially in the Middle East and so forth. I mean, I would say it's more likely that in 5 years' time, oil will be much higher than it is now than much lower.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I appreciate you spending so much time with us, Mark Faber. He is the editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. Website is www.gloomboomdoom.com. We'll put a link on that. And calling him from Thailand, which I hope the next time I'm there, we could share some, we'll go to one of those local markets and have some fresh fish, pad Thai, and some of the fresh Thai beer together. How's that?
Yes, sure.
All right. I'll see you soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Perfect.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was a little gloomy, but I think it was quite educational and informational because, I mean, he's got it right. I mean, these some of our leaders right now are, you know, talking about some things that are just astonishing, aren't they? I mean, they're talking about really bankrupting our children and generations to come, and I'm not going to rehash all this right now, but, you know, I always want to hear what you have to say as well, so do me a favor, just comment away. That's what this is all about. This is a two-way conversation. I'm in your ears, but I want to hear what you have to say, so come on over to the Disciplined Investor and let me hear about that. As I promised you in the beginning of the show today, we are going to give you the opportunity to download a free copy of The Disciplined Investor. And what you can do is there's going to be a link. It's going to start on Wednesday. Coming up in just a couple of days. I think that's the 18th. And basically, the 18th of February through Friday, what you can do is you go over to a special link that we've set up over at MSN Money and click on that, and you'll be able to download it. So what you'll find is that you need to check back. We'll have the link available on the website starting on Wednesday. It'll be all over MSN. You'll see it all over the news for the free download. Do me a favor, please. We're trying to get as many people to download. This is a one-shot deal. We're not doing this again. So if you can make sure to tell everybody that you know, send them a link, tell them to, you know, maybe listen to the podcast and maybe just hop on over to The Disciplined Investor on Wednesday so they can get that link. We'll make sure it's at the top of the page. We'll put that link, and they can get their free download and start on their way to becoming a disciplined investor. It's that easy. It's all you have to do. I want you to make sure that you're safe. This whole thing where we made such great money throughout the most, probably the roughest time, well, it's clearly the roughest time that I've ever seen in my career, but in decades and decades and decades, and the greatest slope down in such a incredibly compacted time frame that I have ever seen clearly in forever. And I want to make sure that everybody can do their best to understand about the markets and what they're doing. I mean, it makes no sense to be a novice investor throwing your money in this kind of market, which frankly is not even situated well for a professional investor. It's a very dangerous place right now. But the more you know, the more knowledge that you have, I think the better off you'll be. So with that in mind, please do me a favor. Please make sure to tell a few friends, email them, tell them to come on over to disciplinedinvestor.com, get that link and download their copy of my book. It's going to be all 100% all of the pages, nothing left out, so they can download it for themselves and use it and learn and understand all about the Quanta Funda Tecna process. So I hope that's going to help you out. I hope that's something that I'm doing to give you a little leg up on your competition and to make sure that your portfolio is a little bit safer. We talk about all the different components of investing in that book and give you a good baseline understanding of what it's all about. So with that in mind, I thank you for listening today. I hope we didn't freak you out too much with Dr. Faber. It's kind of spooky to me to think about all the negative issues that potentially could happen. And like I said, next week, we're going to bring you a lot more on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.